The unmistakable sound of Alice Cooper, of course. He's reached 75 Python's guillotine stage blood. Alice Cooper is widely considered the godfather of shock rock, thanks to his concoction of vaudeville, horror film, and three chord rock and roll. Nothing wrong with that. In Alice Cooper at 75, veteran rock journalist Gary Graff shows us rock icon through the lens of 75 career accomplishments, events, and partnerships. Delighted to be joining me from live on the line from the States, the man behind the book, Alice Cooper 75, Gary Graff. Gary, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Absolutely, and snowing here in Detroit. So happy to have your sunny disposition to talk to today.
We've only just started, so careful what you wish for. We were just chatting off air, and it is quite something that Alice Cooper actually made it to 75. Because if you were to do a straw poll, it's 1973. You know, rock stars. Actually, think about it. Rock stars least likely to make it, and you've got Keith Richards as always. You've got Ozzy, and he's still just about with us, and Alice Cooper, because we weren't expecting him to make the end of the week, never mind 75.
I mean, that's an occupational hazard when you're sticking your head in a guillotine every night or submitting yourself to a gallows or something. Certainly that was cause for concern. But you know, Alice did go through, and he has spoken about it at great length. He went through some very severe substance addictions that did almost kill him. And had to come out the other end of that. So, and at the time, 1973, again, when you're getting your head cut off every night on stage, he was also waking up in the morning to a six pack of Budweiser. Oh. And then would switch to a fifth of whiskey sometime during the day. So this is a guy who was doing a lot of damage to himself along the way. And yes, he would have been one of the ones you earmarked for an early demise.
But the other thing is the fact that people though maybe don't realize how incredibly hard Alice Cooper worked with the band. I mean, the early band would lock themselves away in a barn, if I remember correctly, and they were always rehearsing. It wasn't sort of like Skinner have a six pack and then sort of wander down to Muscle Shoals and or knock out another one. It was really hard graft. There was nothing, although the lifestyle might have been rock and roll, the discipline was almost Prussian in the way that he made his band rehearse.
Well, and they were a band at the time. You know, Alice Cooper was a band before it became a band, and they lived together for the first 7 years at least of the band's existence. You referenced the barn. That was actually out here in the Detroit area in Pontiac, Michigan, where they had moved. During 1970, they weren't cutting in and out in Los Angeles, and they said, okay, we're going to go to the first place where we get a standing ovation. Turned out to be in Michigan, which of course is where Alice is from. He was born in Detroit. So they wrote the material for the breakthrough material, I'm 18, Love It to Death, Killer, in a barn in Pontiac, Michigan, where their neighbors and test audience were the residents of an asylum next door. And somehow that's very appropriate that's the Alice Cooper sound came together being auditioned for those people watching from the fences that divided the property. But they lived together there. They lived together in Los Angeles, and they lived together for a while in Connecticut in a great big mansion.
It seems that most rock acts were doing that sort of thing, because obviously the band and you've got the band in Big Pink, you've got, you know, quite a few bands who lock themselves away. The Allman Brothers, for example, that band. Oh, yeah. I mean, hugely. But it's interesting, because if you think of the sounds that came out from the Allman Brothers or the band, that's that sort of very, very hippie love kind of country, you know, drawing on, you know, the experience of the Civil War in the band's case, etc. Alice Cooper, the band, had been around for a while and tried to do the psychedelic thing, but it didn't click. But when they hit upon this like early 70s schlock rock, absolutely found a niche.
Absolutely. And they like to say, their line and Alice's key line is, we're the band that put the stake in the heart of the Love Generation. They were the anti-hippie. They were the counter to the counterculture. And they connected in a big way. You know, nobody was doing death on stage. This was coming out of Peace, Love, Drugs, and No War. And here's this guy killing people, killing himself, being redeemed. A big part of the Alice Cooper story, stage show story, is that it is a story of redemption, kind of. But, you know, they were the counter to the counterculture back then, absolutely.
And if you think about it, they time it just right, because by 72, 73, you know, the love generation and the acid trip has turned bad. You know, we've had Aldemont, which is obviously always heralded as the death of the generation. But then we go through Vietnam, you know, various bad people start dying, literally start dying off in the rock business. Obviously, the three, Janis, Jimmy, and Jim. And there's a new, and we have the energy crisis, and things aren't looking so rosy. And so something like as tongue-in-cheek as Alice comes along, and people go, yeah, I can relate to that. I can. And it's just in the UK, we've got glam coming up as well, which is kind of linked, although Alice is obviously harking back to those sort of fabulous Roger Corman B movies type thing.
Yeah, very much so. And you also had the next generation, and I'm one of them. I had a brother who was a hippie. And he turned me on to a lot of great music when I was very young. But by the time I get into my teenage years, I want something of my own. And a lot of people got that with Led Zeppelin. You know, that was really a key factor too. And Black Sabbath to a degree, but Alice was a whole different thing. That stage show and the theatricality and the concept, what he was presenting. And then the fact that our older siblings hated it. And our parents hated it. If you were a teenager circa 71, 72, 73, and everybody's hating this guy, you were like, yeah, that's for me. That he's going to be mine. And so that was a big part of it too. You had a lot of factors combining that created a hunger for something brand new that generation of music fans could wrap their arms around.
Yeah, and when you're sort of a hoary old rocker like myself, you know, who's been around a bit, and you see things like the outcry, the outrage that happened, what, 20 years ago with Marilyn Manson, and I'm just going, the music, which sound, those double drum beats sound awfully familiar from the 70s, and B, the outlook as well. It's like, I have seen this before and done better and done without the CGI and the new makeup, because this is what Alice Cooper was doing 1972, 1973, and the outrage and the moral majority were losing their minds in the UK, in the US, the UK and Europe at the time.
What I love about the Alice story, and, you know, there's a whole chapter in the book about this, is the people that got it were the guys in what was called the Friars Club back here in the States. These were the old time Milton Berle, Bob Hope, Jack, you know, Burns, all these guys got it. And they loved Alice. They saw in Alice, though, here's a contemporary update of the vaudeville that we created. Alice used to tell me that George, or Alice has told me that George Burns used to tell him, yeah, Gracie and I, you know, back in 1923, we were on the road with this guy who had a guillotine and he used to cut his head off. And so that group, the people you would expect would hate him, Frank Sinatra, these guys loved Alice Cooper because they understood exactly what he was doing and they felt a kinship with what he was doing.
Now that surprises me. Not that, and, you know, that well known rocker George Burns. You know, hey, him hanging out with Ozzy. But I can get the, and I want to come on to the vaudeville. But for Sinatra to like them, because Sinatra was he hated hippies. I mean, he may have married, you know, Maya Farrow in a moment or whatever, but he was that, you know, Italian American construction, shall we say? You know, he was Havana, he was Vegas, and so he didn't like hippies. Full stop. Or any of that modern rock music. So I suppose, but then again, yeah, it's the show, isn't it? It's the vaudeville, it's the Vegas. Right.
It was the concept. It was the idea. Those old time entertainers, Groucho Marx too, saw in Alice Cooper a 1970s update of what they were doing, you know, just in terms of the idea where he was drawing it from. And Alice used to acknowledge that influence too. He grew up a child of 1950s, early 1960s pop culture, which was very much, you know, vaudeville was still part of that, although we called it the variety show on TV. And he really grew up on the game shows and the variety shows and the B horror movies.
And if you think about it, because at that time period, TV is new. It's 50. It's the American dream. You're a young Alice Cooper. And that will be, people are thinking, good grief, yeah, Alice Cooper is a young child. But watching, you know, the nation watched TV. Ed Sullivan. The Beatles, you know, broke America because they appeared on the Ed Sullivan show. And there were, you know, before the internet, before whatever, the whole nation watched this. And so TV was in its infancy. It needed something to fill the time. It needed people who were good live. So obviously it's going to go back to that we would call it music hall, you would call it vaudeville tradition, which there were millions of artists out there.
There completely were. And then, but that had gone away. The early rock and roll ethos was, we don't want any of that. That's hokey. And so it was bands the Beatles had a look. It became bands. Yeah, we're going to wear T-shirts. We're going to wear jeans. We're just going to get up there and play our music, which, cool, that worked for a while. And you also had, at that time, you had the great psychedelic light artists to turn the shows into shows. The band, it wasn't on the bands to do that. You know, you had the crazy world of Arthur Brown. But that wasn't the same as Alice Cooper. Yeah. You know, I mean, this was full-blown Busby Berkeley, MGM musical theater, live on a rock and roll stage with songs about dead babies.
Yeah. And if but you think about it as well, because Screaming Jay Hawkins had been doing this. He got his persona on that with the walking cane with the skull on it and all that sort of Louisiana, New Orleans sort of,
the voodoo
sort of stuff. So people could get this. We talk about the problems he had, with drinking drugs and the whole thing, but was he intelligent enough to be able to talk to, a Sinatra, a George Burns, a Bob Hope? Then there's that, the classic Wayne's World sketch, isn't there, when he's talking about the Native American
history of Milwaukee.
Exactly. But he obviously has the intelligence, because if he was just, with the greatest thrill of the world, something tells me that Ozzy possibly couldn't do that. So, he had the intelligence as well.
Absolutely. I mean, an incredibly bright guy, well-educated, and he will tell you that he was the most coherent drunk in the world. even 2 6-packs into the day, he was still coherent and could still talk. So that's still very much a factor of who he is. Very knowledgeable, very well-read. He was raised to be that way, too. You know, he came out of a church family, but also a hardworking Midwestern family where education and being smart were real values, and both he and his sister were steered that way.
I heard the story, and I would love to know if it's true, Gary, and you're probably the man to tell me, about Zappa and Alice Cooper, and Zappa had said to Cooper, come by and play at my house at 7 o'clock. It is true.
Can you just tell
the story there? Because you probably know.
Sure, So, they were looking for a record company. The Alice Cooper Band had moved to Los Angeles and then named themselves renamed themselves and done the whole shtick. And they were looking for a deal. They had become friendly with the GTOs, who were the groupie group that recorded for Frank Zappa and his label. So they said, Frank, you got to check out these guys. Frank had heard about them, and what appealed to him most was that nobody liked them. So he's like, if nobody likes you, there must be something here. Come by my house at 7 o'clock, 7 a.m. Frank Zappa wakes up to crash, bang, electric guitars, and he puts his bathrobe on, walks down the stairs, and what the hell is going on? You said to come at 7. 7 o'clock, you freaks. So that was a true story.
Yeah, but it also underlines how businesslike Alice is, because it's 7 guys, get up, we're going. They won't have been at the whiskey or whatever, some club, and then stumbled in. They were there. They were tight at that time in the morning. I don't know how tight
they were at 7, but they were there. They were certainly there. That's a great story. And their history with Zappa was a very interesting one. And Zappa's line was, I don't get you, but I'm going to sign you.
Perfect. Perfect. I mean, Renegades, massive success, especially in the UK with Schools Out. I mean, it becomes a huge worldwide hit, and several bands would kind of implode, but they handled it well. And then, of course, the original band sort of, shall we say, goes on its merry way, because Alice just goes, right, bam, that's it. I'm the mate. This is me now.
It was actually a little more involved than that. There was growing resentment in the band that Alice Cooper became the man and not the band. You know, the other guys always figured the fame would catch up to them one day, and it didn't. And they reached a certain point where they made the Muscle of Love album and insisted that this be more of a band effort, not so much Bob Ezrin, who was their producer and the guy who had really honed them into shape. And so they did that album, and then Michael Bruce, the guitarist, wanted to do a solo album. And there was just a lot going on, a lot of personality, a lot of ego clashing. And basically it came down to when Alice was ready to get back to work, the other guys weren't. So Alice and Shep Gordon, his manager, very important part of the story, said, well, we've got this thing we're going to do. Maybe we'll see you later. And later didn't come until the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know.
But he keeps going on. He keeps performing. I mean, there's always that the lost years period. So we say to the 70s and in the 80s. But, and I always say this, but rock fans are the most loyal fans in the world. And if they like an artist and if it speaks to them, they'll stay with them. And obviously...
I was going to say, certainly, especially at that time, and now not so much, and this is a larger discussion we won't get into here. Now it's a lot harder for a rock band to build that kind of loyal audience. But when Alice came along, first of all, by sheer dint of having not one but two generational albums, I'm 18 and School's Out, which will never, ever, ever go out of fashion. By having that and that connection and having older siblings introduce their younger siblings to it, Alice Cooper has been able to maintain that type of following and build that following, you know, ever since.
And what the other trick he managed to pull off, which if you can get away with it is brilliant, is he kept doing what he was doing, but he managed to pull back and sort himself out before he became a caricature of himself, before he became, if you like, yeah, I'm Alice Cooper and I'll just do my best of hits and I'm supposed to act this way, which you see a lot of rock stars fall into and they're very unhappy. But, you know, he gets this moment of clarity, he gets this revelation, he sorts himself out, and then when he comes back, he finds himself, like we said, you know, being fated in the Wayne's World movie, etc.
And being more engaged in what he's doing than he was before. I would argue that the 2023 model Alice Cooper is actually more ferocious than the 1973 model is, because he gets it and he's honed it. And he, key to that is he, Alice Cooper, the person, came to understand that Alice Cooper, the character on stage, only needs to exist 80 or 90 minutes a day. The other 22 and a half hours of the day, that Alice Cooper plays golf and goes shopping and is a family guy and all of those things. But that allowed him to keep the Alice Cooper character vital. And like I say, more ferocious than ever, and to keep that standard of quality so high, you know, for a guy who is in his sixth decade of work and is in his 70s, to maintain that caliber and that level of quality to the music, to the stage act, is very rare. And I think the audience recognizes that.
And not only that, but he has these famous side projects. I mean, the Hollywood Vampires,
with Johnny Depp and Joe Perry.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, I mean, I suppose the thing is, people go to look at Johnny Depp and they stay for the music. I mean, that's, if you like, at first sight, oh look, it's Captain Jack Sparrow with a band, but he's taking his music seriously. And now that the other two are kind of cleaned up, it's just he's doing stuff now that he wouldn't have been able to do, and he has his health, which you're seeing some other people at his age are now having major problems with. And you've got people like Gene Simmons, like going, yeah, I told you so, yeah, here I am, I'm still here, Carmen Appice. But he's able to engage, and he's able still to be vital, isn't he? He's able to be inducted into the Hollywood the Rock and Roll Walk of Fame, for example.
Sure, and all those things, and he's still making music, and I think that's so key to it, and what so many of these artists who take 5, 6, 10 years between their albums. Alice is kicking them out every 2 or 3 years, and they're of a high quality. That's, again, larger discussion, the nature of the music industry. It's hard for a guy like Alice Cooper to have a big hit anymore. That doesn't mean the albums aren't good and aren't very worthwhile.
But as we said at the beginning, you know, rock fans are the most loyal fans in the world. And also, he did what they're not doing now. So he came up with that band, originally the Alice Cooper band, the hard way, you know, playing all those backroom gigs, all those tiny gigs around the States. So when they hit the big time, they were honed and they knew what to do. Whereas today you can argue, whack something on TikTok, whack something on a YouTube video, you're the next big thing, and then you don't know how to handle it and you burn out and you haven't learned your musical chops and you're gone literally in 18 months.
Yeah, it's very much the nature of this business right now. But you do see these veterans who were hated when they started. And I think being hated teaches you how to be good, and also teaches you to appreciate the appreciation when it comes along.
And it adds a certain edge to your performance. You know, I mean, that's what the punks did all the time as well. And we can have a whole argument about that and proto-punk. How do you boil it down to 75 then? 75 items? Because you could have put a one in front of that, couldn't you?
Oh, and I did when I made the long list. The long list was about 150 items. And then, you know, I got to work and hacked it down to about 120. And then I figured out how to cheat. And so how could one chapter, you know, 75 chapters, one for each element, how could I incorporate a little bit of something else into each chapter so that each chapter isn't necessarily just about one thing, encompasses others? Maybe that's cheating, maybe it's not, but I was able to tell more of the story that way. And the nice thing about this format, you know, the 75 chapters and 75 elements in his career, is it works as what I call a needle drop. You can stick your finger in the book, flip it open, and read a nice self-contained chapter. Or if you want to read it start to finish, it's a nice linear narrative.
And not only that needle drop, you can go back and check out the music if you're not familiar with it, because it goes, okay, developed. Because that's one of the great things about biography. You will find stuff in, if you're a casual Alice Cooper fan like myself, I wasn't aware of it, of his early 90s stuff. And you can go, okay, fine, and go and check it out. Also, the images. Brilliant. I mean, absolutely, it's a beautiful book.
This is the third book I've done with this publisher, and they do tremendous work. They really do. And this, you know, we're in this day and age, and this applies to the music business too, where people aren't buying physical products nearly as much as they used to. So if you want to sell a physical product, it better be really special. It better be an experience that you can't have downloading it. And I guarantee you the feel of this black velvet cover, you will not get from a download.
You just, as long as it doesn't come with a small guillotine just to keep you on your toes, you'll be...
Watch out for the snake when you open the cover.
Well, coming from the man himself, what do you hope that people take from the book, Gary? And was it superb fun to actually put it all together?
Oh, absolutely. You know, because I'm an Alice Cooper fan. He and I are friendly. We've played golf together and everything. What I hope people take from it is that he is more than the guy who chops his head off and hacks up baby dolls. That this is a very good artist, a good songwriter, a really good human being as well, and somebody who's lived this extraordinary life that has touched more facets of our own lives than we realize.
Now, you probably won't know this, but I'm sitting just outside in the studio, just outside Marbella in Spain, and this is a Costa del Sol, but it is called the Costa del Golf as well. We are known for our golf courses, Valderrama, etc., Ryder Cup. I have to ask you this question because the golf listeners will be saying, what is Alice Cooper's golf game like, and what's it like doing nine holes with Alice Cooper?
Well, fortunately, I've gotten to do 18 a few times. So he's a really good golfer. I mean, beyond really good. He's not quite scratch, you know, but he plays a really good game. I mean, kicks my butt, you know, whenever it happens, which I expected. And, you know, he's this wiry guy.
Yeah.
But you know, he knows it's not about the power. It's about the process. And his swing is so good that he is just smacking it like crazy.
And the process has kept him at the top of his game, both golf-wise and music-wise.
And music-wise.
For decades. The book is called Alice Cooper at 75. It's by Gary Graff, who we'll be talking to today. Gary, if people want to go and follow you and worship at the altar of all things Cooper and also Gary Graff, where can they find you?
Two places, if Twitter's not too weird for you anymore, Graff on Music, that's G-R-A-F-F on Music, or on Facebook, Gary Graff on Music.
The book is called Alice Cooper at 75. It's by Gary Graff. Gary, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.